Danny and I found it, we used dynamite to clear the debris so that we could have a way into the larger natural tunnel inside, maybe carved out from the reservoirs. That's probably where they are. Just inside the opening, there were two broom handles sticking out of a medium-sized plastic garbage can with a lid that had a hole in it along with a lighter. Enoch pulled out a sawed-off floor mop that had seen better days and palmed the lighter. The smell was unmistakable. Kerosene? Yeah. He held the flame to the mop head, and it slowly lit. One of the torches is missing, so they're in there. Enoch held his up, and I was starting to feel like I was in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. I lifted the lid and pulled the remaining mop from the can, aiming it toward his. He pulled it away.
You don't trust me?
I thought about it. Not really.
What would the next person do?
What, you're planning on a meeting? I held the thing closer and he finally lit it, albeit with a frown on his face. Remarkably, there was no writing on the walls, and the cave was pretty broad. I could see where it narrowed ahead, so I attempted to stay close to Enoch. Even with my own torch, I wasn't sure if I wanted him too far out of sight. He turned sideways, keeping the light in front of him, and continued on, looking back only once.
Well, come on.
From the angle of the rock, you could see it was the same formation shelf as the ridge that contained Jen, and I couldn't help but wonder what had hollowed the cave out other than human beings. I watched as he squeezed his way through, and as I attempted to negotiate the same space, I could see his torch turn a slight corner and continue on. Hey, Enoch, slow down, would you? The passage was about as wide as a hallway, and I stepped off at a lopsided jog, turning the corner at the end of the thoroughfare just in time to see his torch in the distance. I went around an abutment and found myself in a spacious passage with a smooth floor made out of compacted dirt. I looked to the right and could see that the path was at least as large as the one I'd just been in, whereas the one to my left was narrow. Picking the one of least resistance, I headed right, figuring that if I didn't see Enoch in a straightaway or hit a turn pretty quick, he must have gone to the left. I continued on, even though I was aware that my shoulders were scraping both walls. I was pleased to see another opening ahead, and figured that he must be in there. But he wasn't. The chamber was the size of a one-stall garage, with a couple of other tunnels leading in opposite directions, but nothing that looked, on closer inspection, promising. With just a little panic setting in, I retraced my steps back into the original tunnel and struck out back to the area where I'd been. Looking up at the rock ceiling, and having faith that it was sturdy, and still hoping that Enoch was on the level and that it was only his familiarity with the cave that had caused him to accidentally escape me, I started allowing my thoughts to grow dark. What if he'd turned the corner and then doused his torch, leaving me, well, in the dark? There was another opening to my right, this one even bigger than the first, but it separated into two tunnels, also angling off in opposite directions. I chose the larger one and switched the torch to my left hand so that I could hold my 45. Better safe than sorry. Setting off, I suddenly felt my boots splashing in water and held the torch so that I could see the shiny surface and the image of myself looking back up at me. Great. With retreat being my only other recourse, I started wading forward, fearing that if the water got thigh deep, I was turning back no matter what. There was a series of bulb sockets overhead in this passage, strung together with old cloth-insulated wiring, which led me to believe that the place had been electrified back in the dirty 30s or possibly the 40s. Too bad there aren't any bulbs or a switch. I continued to study the ceiling, and as I did, I could see that my torch was making black marks on the roof of the cave. Stunned that I hadn't thought of it before, I stood there looking at marks on the rock when I noticed that some were darker. This one time in the cave, I was thankful for my size. I reached up and rubbed a finger on the ceiling and withdrew with a completely fresh black fingertip. Sighing a breath of relief, and trusting my black smudge technique to at least show me where the most recent occupants of the cave had passed, I waded ahead, ignoring the other passageways. To my right was what I was pretty sure was a handmade ladder. As I got closer, I could see that the thing was constructed of lodgepole pine, and I was just as glad not to have been responsible for carrying those into the narrow passageways. I ran a finger over the rung closest to my face and noticed it was wet. Enoch, or somebody, had climbed this way. The treads were roped on, and the rails of the thing shot up through a break in the rocks above. I slipped my sidearm back into its holster and decided to climb. Placing my boot, dripping with water, on the first rung, I shifted my weight and listened to the loud crack as it split in two. I stood there in the semi-dark, muttering, which had no effect on the broken step whatsoever. Lifting my leg a little higher, I rested my boot on the next rung, this time gently applying my weight until the majority was on the ladder. Sighing, I lifted myself up, holding the torch in my right hand a little away from the rope so that I wouldn't set them on fire. The rung held, and I listened to the wood squeal as I placed my other boot on the next and slowly climbed up with my hip still aching. There was a trapdoor with hinges and a handle at the top of the ladder. From the distance I'd climbed, I calculated that I must be pretty close to the surface. I thought about pulling my sidearm again, but I was sure that if I made some sort of dramatic entrance, the ladder was likely to buckle and dump me, the torch, and my 45 back in the cave. Carefully taking the handle, I raised the trapdoor an inch or two so that I could see the interior of what looked to be an old lineman's shack, a small, rough-cut wooden structure. The portion I could see had an empty bunk against the wall, a closed door, and Enoch Lone Elk sitting in the chair in my slicker, a single-barrel shotgun pointed at the opening.
"Hi, Sheriff. Mind if I climb the rest of the way out?" "You better. I'm not sure if that ladder will hold you for too much longer."
Lifting the hatch the rest of the way with my right hand, I climbed out and sat on the floor with the torch still in my left, and commented on the small pot-bellied stove crackling with a few burning logs.
"You had time to make a fire?"
He kept the shotgun on me.
"Took you a while."
There were moments when I wasn't sure I was going to make it at all. He nodded.
"Lot of caves down there. We cleared a bunch, but there are a bunch more."
He gestured with the single barrel.
"Stuff that torch in the fire there."
I did as he said and watched as the flames leapt a little at the introduction of the extra fuel.
"You and Danny?" "We were redoing the floor in this place and found a trap. Pulled it up and discovered the cave down below. Figure they must have used it to get away or store stuff."
"Who?"
"Don't know. Found empty bottles of hooch from the 20s, so it might have been used by bootleggers, and who knows before that, maybe Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, for all I know."
He gestured with the shotgun again.
"Want to close that thing? Causes a draft."
I closed the door in the floor and reached out to warm my hands near the fire, noticing a pot of coffee on the stove and a few tin cups. "You know, if I hadn't found my way up here, you'd have had a lot of explaining to do."
"You would have just disappeared. People disappear in this country."
"Like Jennifer Watt?" He said nothing, and I poured myself a cup of coffee and set the pot back on the stove under his careful eye. "And Taylor?" I studied him. "What's going on, Enoch?" He unsnapped a few of the clasps on my slicker and pulled a drenched hat from his head, ignoring bad luck and throwing it on the bunk.
"You're a smart fellow. You tell me."
I sipped the coffee, and it tasted wonderful. "I was just about convincing myself that you didn't have anything to do with the death of your brother."
"I didn't."
I gestured with the cup toward the shotgun. "Then why is one of us having this conversation at gunpoint?"
"Just slowing you down so that the young ones can get away."
He didn't move, but his eyes drifted from me toward the fire.
"Danny was hard on Randy, and now Randy's hard on that boy, so I'm putting a stop to it."
"Danny was hard on Randy?" The older man nodded.
"Danny was drinking. and worked Randy like a mule, but it made him tough. Made him capable. Randy's been tough on Taylor, but all it's done is wear the boy down. I knew both Eva and Randy wouldn't want that boy running off with a white girl, so I took a hand.
I nodded. Where are they headed?
None of your business. Actually, it is my business. Someone murdered your brother. They didn't have anything to do with that.
Then who did? He didn't answer. Just sat there with the shotgun pointed at me. I noticed the hammer wasn't pulled back.
Enoch, I'm having a hard time believing that you would shoot me. Don't want to, but I need you to stay put for a while.
Then what? There's an APB out on the two of them, and every highway patrolman in the territory is going to be looking for whatever vehicle they're in.
Drink your coffee.
I did, and then set the empty cup down on the kindling box. Enoch, I've had a little drama in my family just lately, too. My son-in-law was killed a day ago, shot in a routine traffic stop in Philadelphia, where he was a police officer. So now my daughter's going to have to go through what I've been going through for a bunch of years since my wife died. I rubbed my face with my one hand and then dropped it in my lap with the other one and looked at him. That's something I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, let alone the two people more important to me than everything. I sighed and shook my head at the thought of it. But now there she is with a brand new daughter and no husband to help her. She needs me. And if you think I'm going to sit here and sip coffee and pass the time of day with you, you got another think coming. As I started to stand, he raised the bore of the barrel toward my face.
Hold up right there.
And it's going to take a hell of a lot more than that shotgun to stop me. I stood. Besides, my hip hurts, and my legs are getting stiff from sitting on this floor. I arched my back and straightened my hat. I'm stiff all over, but I think I'm mostly tired. Tired of everything, to tell the truth. I walked past him as he stood and rested a hand on the doorknob. You can go ahead and shoot me if you want, but as tired as I am, I can't guarantee that I'll feel it. It was about then that everything went black and I realized I'd been wrong about a couple of things, that Enoch was not afraid to use that shotgun and that shotgun had stopped me after all. Number one, the sudden deceleration or acceleration of the head is pretty important in a concussion, generally occurring when the blow is from the side or from behind with, say, the butt of a single-barreled shotgun. I tried to rise up on one forearm, but it wouldn't support me, so I just lay there. Number two, evidence suggests that a good concussive blow that results in a knockout generally has a twisting motion which results in the brain reacting within the skull, something like a mixmaster. I finally opened my eyes and stared at the floor, expecting pools of blood but not seeing any through the crashing waves of tsunami pain that were attempting to overturn my brain in its pan. Incapable of much else, I rolled over and looked at the ceiling and listened to my breath rattle, the warm air from my lungs creating a cloudy vapor in the now cold interior. As I thought back, I could only come up with a handful of times this had happened to me, which is good because I felt like my brains were leaking out of my ears. Sitting up, I noticed that Enoch must have covered me with my slicker. I picked up my hat and carefully placed it on my head, avoiding the lump, and rubbed my face. It was still raining, and the fire in the stove was out, the torch end having burned off and fallen to the floor, which gave me an indication of how long I must have been lying there. Too long. Struggling to my feet by sliding my back against the door, I stood, sort of, and looked through the grimy windows. It was still dark out, early morning being my guess, before sunup at least. Feeling the bile rising in my throat, I swallowed and stretched my jaw and felt for my .45, relieved to find it still in my holster. Taking a few unsteady steps, I went over to the stove and felt the coffee pot. Cold, but still half full. I picked up the tin cup, refilled it, and took a swig to clear the taste from my mouth. Taking a few steps, I draped the slicker over a shoulder and threaded an arm through a sleeve, stopping to rest before threading the other. I waited a moment and then buckled the thing closed, flipping up the collar and pulling my hat down in the front. Grasping the knob, I turned it and stumbled around the door as the wind and rain blew it against me, and I trudged into the dark, not really sure where I was and certainly not sure about where I was going. The rain wasn't as hard as I remembered it being before, but the wind had picked up. Since it generally came from the northwest, I tacked into it and down a hill onto what appeared to be an old cow path. Figuring that Enoch must have taken Bambino, I decided not to look for him and kept walking, assuming I'd eventually find a road and start my way back toward civilization on foot. The cow path turned to the left and stayed on the lowland and out of the wind, for which I was thankful. My head was killing me, and all of a sudden, while wiping the rain from my face, I found myself lying on the path, struggling in the mud to stand. I fell down a few more times, but then managed to keep my footing. It felt like I was walking for 100 miles, but I just ignored time and distance and kept going, hoping I wasn't just walking in circles and not knowing it. Trudging through the barrow ditch, I climbed up the hillside, and when I got there, I kneeled in an attempt to catch my breath and fight back the vertigo. I breathed heavily, again watching the vapor trail from my nostrils, and stood, at first a little unsteadily, but then feeling somewhat better. I noticed that the rhythm of my steps was matching my breathing, possibly the only thing that was keeping me going. I pushed my hat up and gripped my forehead in an attempt to chase off the pain, but it stayed right there with me until I unexpectedly ran into something. My thighs struck the blunt edge of a solid impediment, and when I tried to grab whatever it was, I slipped and fell backward. I lay in the road thinking I'd better get up before either I drowned like a turkey or something ran over me. There was a lot of noise, and I swore I could hear voices as somebody, two somebodies actually, picked me up, trailed my arms over their shoulders, and dragged me to the back seat of a car. "The Bobs," I mumbled. "What did he say?" "Something about not letting go." Chapter 14. I was seeing double. I shook my head. Another mistake in that now my brain felt like it was bouncing around like a sneaker in a washing machine. "Good thing you've got a hard head," Bob DeLude made a face as the Bobs stood at the foot of my hospital bed like bookends. Sitting the rest of the way up, I could see Henry and Doc Bloomfield at the side of my bed. "You know, I'm really getting tired of waking up in this place." I could feel the bandages wrapped around my skull as I rested back on a collection of pillows. "Has anyone found Jennifer and Taylor?" Henry shrugged, and I looked at the two patrolmen who followed suit. "What about Enoch?"
"Also missing."
The Cheyenne Nation sat in the nearest chair.
"We were hoping you could tell us where everyone was, but we did find the horse."
"Do me a favor?"
"Yes. Shoot him." "Too late. We already returned him safe and sound to the corral at the Lone Elk Ranch."
He studied me.
"Did the horse have something to do with all this?"
"Well, kind of. The biggest problem was Enoch." I yawned and could hear cracking noises. Probably not a good sign.
"My head hurts."
Robert Hall spoke up. "We've got an APB out on the two. Should we add Enoch?"
"Yep."
I glanced around.
"Where are my clothes?"
"Locked up." The doc's voice was firm as he pulled at his nose with a thumb and forefinger. "DCI sent back the official report on Danny Lone Elk." Now, why do I not like the sound of that? "All indications are that Danny died of mercury poisoning." I glanced at the other men in the room, but they seemed as concerned as I was.
"Mercury poisoning?"
The doc nodded. Yes. If you'll remember, I remarked on the flesh shedding at the fingertips.
Other symptoms?
Isaac recited. Tremors, emotional changes, insomnia, impairment of peripheral vision, headaches, lack of cognitive function, all the things that Danny had been suffering from that lately might have been misconstrued as alcoholism.
The rattle. They all looked at me. The turtle rattle that Danny kept getting out and placing on his chest when he took his naps. It had a strong smell to it, and I remember Dave Bauman saying that the things were dangerous because of the residual chemicals that remained from the museum's cleaning them. He mentioned mercury specifically.
I happened to catch Henry's eyes as they played out through the dark past the windows.
What?
He turned to look at me.
Fish.
He stood, placing his fingertips on the surface of the glass.
High levels of methylmercury can be retained in fish and shellfish.
I stared at him.
Are you saying that Danny ate enough fish that he... Well, in Danny's case, not exactly fish.
He turned to look at me.
Turtles.
Oh, hell. I thought about it. Didn't Randy say that Eva fixed their dad turtle soup all the time?
She did. But still, where's the mercury coming from?
I watched as Isaac thumbed up his glasses and massaged the bridge of his nose, a habit when in deep thought. 40% of mercury poisoning in the U.S. comes from power plants, but once again, there's nothing like that in the area. I thought about the conversation I'd had with the hardened hippie.
Turtle food.
They all looked at me. The herbalist pharmacologist up in Hardin told me that he sold turtle food to Danny by the truckload. I turned to the Cheyenne Nation.
What do turtles eat?
He smiled, the thin-lipped smile, the one that cut paper or red tape.
Fish.
Most of that crap that Freebird is selling is illegal Chinese stuff, and I'm sure it's probably laced with mercury because it's too bad to sell to humans.
Bob shrugged. So you think his death actually was an accident? I am not sure, but if somebody knew about the mercury in the feed, and subsequently the turtles in combination with the sacred rattle...
Eva? I looked at the bear.
You think?
I turned to Isaac.
Doc, I need my clothes, now.
As I hurried out, I spoke to the assembled posse. So as near as I can tell, Taylor and Jennifer have a thing, and Uncle Enoch is helping them along. I looked at the Bobs. Can you guys get down to the Lone Elk place and arrest everybody who is down there? They spoke in unison. Charge?
What?
Since when do you guys need a reason to arrest somebody? I threw out the first thing that came to mind.
Probable cause.
Bob turned to Robert.
I love probable cause.
Robert nodded and looked back at me as they went out the door.
Me too.
So, not that it's any of our business, but where are you two going?
Looking for the star-struck lovers and their guardian. I think I owe Enoch a pop in the jaw.
As the HPs exited, I turned back to the Cheyenne Nation.
We're at Trost in the FBI.
Henry folded his hands in his lap.
They were boxing up more of Jan, but it is late and they gave up when they could not get Jay to run the forklift in the rain.
It's a manhunt. Isn't that what the FBI does best? I pressed my fingers against my right eye, which seemed to want to pop out.
Wait, did you just say it was late?
Henry looked at his wristwatch.
Close to 11. Mr. Hall and Mr. DeLude found you just before dawn, and you have been unconscious all day.
Oh, no. Henry frowned.
Yes. You cannot move in your holding cell. From what I understand, Trost has been in negotiation with the DOJ to have Jen stored in the official depository in Bozeman.
What the hell is he thinking? The bear shrugged.
I guess he has his sights set higher than the big empty.
I'm calling Joe Mayer. I glanced around for a phone, but could see only the internal one for the ICU.
As soon as I get my damn pants.
There were some emergency clothes in my office, which was good because the director of the Cheyenne Conservancy and the chief of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe, along with their bodyguard, were waiting for me. I redressed and limped back into the dispatcher receptionist area. Henry was sitting on the bench with Brandon White Buffalo and Lonnie Littlebird, Lolo Long sitting on Ruby's desk, her long legs dangling. "Sheriff?"
"Chief, what's up?"
She gestured toward the old man, who smiled.
"I'm thinking there's something you should know."
Yes, it is so."
"What's that, Lonnie?"
"There was a meeting a few months ago with the tribal council. And those meetings, they get long, so I sometimes fall asleep." He shook his head. "Which is how I got elected chief, I suppose. I was asleep and couldn't defend myself."
"What about the meeting, Lonnie?"
"What?" He looked at me, his mouth moving in an attempt to continue the conversation, but not quite sure what it was.
"The meeting?"
"Oh, yes. There was a meeting. It is so." I stood there looking at him for a spell, but then finally turned and glanced at Chief Long, who obliged me by reminding him, "The girl, Lonnie." His head rose back with his mouth open, the thought reforming.
"The girl, yes. There was a girl. She came to the first meeting and stood by the door, but then they got her a chair to sit on in the next one, and then by the time we got to the last meeting, she was sitting with us at the table during the negotiations."
"Who is us?"
"Danny. The negotiations with Danny about the Cheyenne Conservancy and the dinosaur."
"Yeah, but who was the girl?"
"The girl with the camera. Yes, it is so."
Lolo added in explanation, "The paleontologist Jennifer Watt."
"She filmed all three of the meetings?"
Brandon sat forward, his giant hands linked under his chin.
"It's true. I remember that there was a blonde woman at the meetings filming. Evidently she and Danny were very good friends, and he had her film everything."
"Yes," Lolo shrugged. "I didn't think anything about it, but then she went missing along with Taylor, and I thought it might be pertinent." I looked at Henry.
"We need to find those two.